financial literacy, and the human condition. Welcome to Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Raham.
Welcome to Financial Fitness. I'm Jess Tyler, along with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Raham. Hi.
Good morning, Jess. How are you?
I'm good. So we get to actually see each other, which is lovely. Today, we are talking about a topic which is really funny because I just heard a funny commercial about it, and it's life insurance.
Oh, really? What? You heard a funny commercial about life insurance? Do tell.
I didn't know how it would work, but it was this commercial that came on that basically said, like, if you're overweight and don't take care of yourself and you're, you know, one step away, call Big Dave because we'll insure even you. And I just thought, is this working? But it must be because they're advertising.
Well, Big Dave might know a little something about that, actually.
It's basically the people that don't want to have to pass like the doctor's requirement part of it, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, that's a kind of it is a funny commercial, but it's meant to be disarming, I'm sure. And it does speak about a very specific kind of life insurance. And so we're going to go over today the different kinds of life insurance, the reasons you might have it, try to sort out some of this mystery about some of the things that are less known than others, and give you some idea about why you might need or not need life insurance, how you figure that out, and what kind would be best for you to get so that you don't fall prey to, well, a big day.
Big day.
A big day.
I'm also curious if we have time to touch on whether there's ever a time that what you get from your employee, you know, when you can times your salary, is that ever enough?
I'm curious from your employer? Mm-hmm. Yeah, from your employer. Yeah, it might be. But okay, so let's start there and we'll talk about Big Dave too. And then we'll go on to other things because I feel like I'm picking on poor Dave. And there's a place for what Dave is saying to do. So, okay. So what you get from your employer, let's say it's three times your salary. Is it enough? Maybe. And maybe while you're still working, what you need to understand is what happens to it when you leave work. Do you get to keep a reduced amount? Like, let's say you have $150,000 of coverage while you're working. If you leave, does your employer say you get to keep a $5,000, say, paid up policy, or you get to pay the premiums on it and keep it? So They can say anything they want about it, basically. It's one of your benefits. You might want to ask your HR people, what happens to my life insurance when I leave, so that you know. Mm-hmm. Because one of the biggest things about life insurance is, and everybody will tell you this, if you buy it when you're young and healthy, it will be cheaper. Mm-hmm. The rub is that when you're young and healthy, you often can't afford much life insurance.
Or you're not really thinking about it. You know, you think you're going to be young and healthy forever.
Yeah, it's true. But okay, so let's talk about Big Dave for a minute.
Okay.
But he's talking about, I'm assuming, and I've not heard the ad, but I'm assuming that he's talking about something we call guaranteed issue life insurance. So just to give you a rough overview, there's so many different kinds of life insurance. There's whole life. There's variable life. There's universal life. There's variable universal life. There's term insurance.
It gets confusing.
Yeah, it gets confusing. And most people don't start by saying, what kind of life insurance do I need? They start by saying, how much life insurance do I need? And then the usual comment is, I'll just get term because it's cheaper. Mm-hmm. Or, no, I want permanent insurance because I don't want it to end.
Can you explain the difference between term and permanent or term and life?
Absolutely. Term and permanent life insurance. Okay, so term insurance is just what it sounds like. It's there for a certain term.
Right? Okay.
It might be 10-year term, 15-year term, 20-year term, 30-year term.
But so not to be, that basically means you have to die within that time period.
Wow, that's a little harsh.
A little hard. I didn't pretty that up at all. But that's basically what it means, right?
I don't think anybody would buy a policy that says they have to die within the term.
If you don't die within this 10 years, you're getting nothing.
But that's kind of how it works, actually. If you don't die within that period of time, the premiums you've paid are gone, right? They've been paying for death benefit only, no cash value, and the policy ends. Okay, so that's term insurance. Now, we're going to talk a little bit about how term can benefit you in a number of ways, but that's how term insurance works versus some sort of permanent insurance like any kind of whole life, variable universal life, those things that build cash value in some way. That's okay. The basic difference. If you don't know if you have term or you have some whole life product and you can't find the words on your statement, do you build cash value or do you not? Mm-hmm. Now, the gray area, there's always a gray area. You might have something like, say, a universal life policy built on a term chassis. So you might be paying for permanent insurance, but as cheaply as you can, mm-hmm. But it's still permanent. It's just not building any or much cash value.
Okay.
So it is. It's a hot mess, right? Insurance is a hot mess.
For sure.
But there are ways to sort through it. So that's the difference between term and permanent insurance. And permanent insurance, we would call some form of whole life contract. As I said, okay. Universal life, variable life, any of those are under the permanent insurance umbrella.
And the whole life is obviously going to be more expensive.
Yes, it is going to be more expensive. And depending on the kind of whole life you buy, it will cost you more in premiums than some others. For instance, a universal life policy may be less expensive than what we call a plain vanilla whole life policy. The question isn't always one of expense, though. The question is often one of value.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how expensive was your term policy if you paid for it for 25 years and didn't use it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It did cover your death benefit, and that's what you wanted it to do. But now you're 25 years older, you may not be in good health, and you might be in the market for insurance again, and now you're going to really pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas some whole life types of policies, universal life is a good example, where you might be able to pay for it for a period of time, it builds up enough cash value to start paying for itself. And it's still permanent insurance. It's not that one of these is better than the other. It's that you have to find the right fit for you.
Is there a time that you would recommend someone get either a term or a whole life insurance policy? Is there a certain age or other factors?
Well, if you're going to die, I think it's a good idea to have some life insurance.
But I mean, would you take it out when you're 30 or would you take it out when you're 60?
Yeah, clearly taking it out when you're younger helps. But life changes. You might need a lot more insurance when you're 30 and you have three small children at home and mm-hmm. not a lot of assets and a wife or a husband that maybe can't support themselves without your income.
Mm-hmm.
Hello, that's a cause for life insurance, right?
Yeah.
You might take it out if you have a business partner who can't run the business successfully if you die without some real capital. So you might take out life insurance and make the business partner the beneficiary on it. So if something happens to you, the business can continue to run, thereby perhaps supporting your family.
Mm-hmm.
Some people will buy it to build cash value tax-free. If they buy a whole life policy and it's funded a specific way and it doesn't breach some guidelines, which you know mm-hmm. upfront, you know, then you might build cash value in there tax-free. That I could go on for about an hour about, but I won't. I'll just say, if someone is selling you a policy telling you you're going to be able to take that cash out tax-free in the future, in my opinion, it better be a big policy. It better be big enough to make that worthwhile. Because when you get these really large policies, you know, $10,000, $15,000, $20,000, $30,000 a month going into a policy like that, you can mm-hmm. build a pile of money that you can take out tax-free in the future. And that
Do
might
you
be
get taxed on it when you take it out or no?
Not if you take it out by loaning it against the policy, which is why I say the policy has to be so large, because if you still want some death benefit, you want to be able to borrow some money against the policy and still keep your death benefit. When you take money out of your whole life type of mm-hmm. out of your permanent life insurance policy, how do you do it? Some people will cash it in. They get a policy, it's got some cash value in it. They see the cash value and they don't think they need the death benefit. So they cash it in and they take the money.
Mm-hmm.
That becomes taxable.
Okay.
That's then a taxable event. Now, I have to say, of course, my disclaimer, I'm not an accountant, right? Mm-hmm. But that becomes taxable. If you borrow the money against your own death benefit, it's a tax-free transaction as long as you didn't breach that MECA guideline we're talking about. Let's say you have a $5 million policy and mm-hmm. it's built up, I don't know, $300,000 of capital. These are ridiculous numbers, but let's just use them. If you take out, you know, $200,000 as a loan against the policy, you don't have to pay it back. You're borrowing your own death benefit. It will accrue interest. So the loan will continue to grow against your death benefit. But if you die, they just subtract it from the death benefit.
I'm assuming that you would recommend then always borrowing against and not taking it out and getting that big tax penalty.
Usually, yes. Okay. I mean, there are times that it makes sense. I've seen people who have built up more cash value than their death benefit is. You know, it's an old policy that a parent bought for them when they were a child or something. They've built up, you know, $15,000 of cash value and they only have $5,000 death benefit. I mean, it's tricky. What you need to do is find an insurance agent that you can trust who's speaking to you and helping you sort these things out in some way that makes sense. I mean, us trying to go through, you know, a life insurance tutorial in half an hour is tricky at best and certainly not, you know, conclusive. So yeah, I said I wanted to talk about Big Dave for a minute.
Okay.
So Big Dave is talking, I think, about another kind of life insurance, which is called guaranteed issue or guarantee issue, depending on who you speak with. Guaranteed issue is something you see it from AARP and some other companies. Sometimes you'll get a flyer in the mail that says no exam necessary, you know, answer three medical questions or no questions, no exam necessary. And there's always some tricky phrase like your premiums will never go up or your death benefit can never go down, right?
Yeah.
Usually the way these things happen is, yes, they will issue them on a guaranteed basis. For instance, I've seen people who have somebody in their family who is terminally ill. They know it. There's no money to pay for a funeral. And the person's been given 2 years to live, right? Well, they might roll the dice and say, we're going to take out a guaranteed issue product because they're not going to get issued, you know, any other kind of insurance. And we're going to make these premium payments, hoping, of course, that their loved one lives longer than the entry period, which is usually 2 or 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so the way it works is something like this, usually. You're going to pay in your premiums. If the person dies after, say, the 3 year mark, you're going to get the whole death benefit. So let's say you're buying a $10,000 policy and you're paying in, you know, $200 a month or whatever the premium is. If they die after the 3 year mark, they've basically made the grade and you're going to get paid the full death benefit. If they die prior to the 3 year mark, you will usually, I know AARP had a product like this. I don't know if they still do, but you would get all your premiums back that you paid plus some interest. And they had a pretty good thing. It was like if they died in the second year, don't quote me on this, but it was something like you got 25% more than your money back or whatever. So you get a reduced death benefit, but it still might be worth doing because you know, you're going to get all your premiums back anyway if you take that kind of policy. But read the small print, because it may not be that way. I mean, I remember that as being one of the better guaranteed issue policies you could buy. But that's, I think, what Big Dave's talking about. And it isn't that people don't want to go through the physicals, although I'm sure, you know, people get frightened about that. But it's pretty minimal what they'll do. They'll usually send a paramed to your house. They'll ask you some questions by phone. You know, they'll get your doctor's records if they need to. But if you're in that situation, maybe not even terminally ill, but just let's say you have a heart problem. Okay, well, you might go for traditional insurance and you might get what we call rated. In other words, you might get a higher premium because you're seen as a higher risk, or you might get declined. If you're declined, you might be calling Big Dave, all right? or preferably searching the market for the best terms you can get on a guaranteed issue contract.
Okay, I have another question on this, which we will get to in the second half. But first, I do want to get your phone number.
Absolutely, Jess. It's 413-773-3333.
And you can go to hugyourmoney.com as well. We'll be right back with the second half of Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Frances Ram. It's coming up on WHMP. Welcome back to Financial Fitness. I'm Jess Tyler along with the Money Doctor, Dr. Frances Ram. Hi, I'm always happy when you're still there. I had a question that I wanted to ask you kind of about Big Dave. So when you're laying in bed at 2 a.m. and can't sleep and you see those infomercials that are kind of the same thing as Big Dave, where it's like, call now, we're going to guarantee this. It's $5 a month and you can get however much. How do you know if it's a scam or not? Because a lot of those just seem way too good to be true.
Well, they may not be a scam. Like, for instance, Big Dave, who we're giving a lot of free advertising to, and I have nothing, I have no idea whether Big Dave's product is any good or not. So please, you know that we're using him as an example here because you had seen that commercial. It's not necessarily that they're a scam, but they may not be the best deal for you. And that's where I would go to somebody that has has some real clout and something to lose, like an AARP who has such a big volume of people that they go and they get really good rates from someone, you know, from a company. I think I remember that contract I was talking to you about was underwritten by New York Life, but it was special terms for AARP. They were competitive terms to New York Life's own policy because they're so big, they can flex their muscle and they can get something like that done. So when you're looking for something like that, you certainly can go to an independent broker. You could call somebody like us or any independent broker and say, I'm looking for some life insurance. Here's my situation. What do you think would work for me? And get some quotes. There are some companies that you can call and just, you know, pretty much any company that you can call and get quotes from. Mm-hmm. I would say it's been my experience. It's not necessarily always true. But when you get the flyer in the mail that says, just check this box and pay this much and there's no premiums or anything due, you know, maybe go shopping.
It's, yeah,
you know, that's a little too easy to just for me to just say, yeah, tick the box and pay the money.
So yeah. I was going to say, you know, if you're listening to this show right now and you don't have life insurance and you're thinking about getting it, what are the first steps? What are the first things you would look for? Obviously, I think you said, you know, call a broker.
Yeah, I think so. But before you do that, I think start to think about why you need life insurance, if you need life insurance and what it does for you. So here's some examples.
Okay.
Let's say, as I said earlier, maybe you're a person with a family, and if you pass away, they cannot make ends meet without you, right? Okay, that's a reason to put some life insurance on yourself. Now, people will say, well, it's expensive. I don't want to pay those premiums. Think about it this way. If you were paying $100 a month for a premium, I forget whether it's affordable for you or not, just for this exercise, but let's say you're paying $100 a month for a premium, and you're buying a $100,000 term policy. How long would you have to shell out $100 a month to lose the game? I mean, you're leveraging your money by so much when you buy life insurance. You pay $100 and you die tomorrow, they pay $100,000. That's
right.
The life insurance game. You're probably never going to pay in $100,000 in premiums at $100 a month, right, to cover that death benefit. So that's the idea, is that you can use your money to leverage it. So that's one example of when you might need life insurance. Another is, let's suppose you have three kids at home and you know, your spouse could do okay, but the kids can't get through college without that money. Here's a very simple one. You have plenty of money. You don't care. Your spouse is going to be fine. You really want to spend down those assets, you know, for your burial and for other things, or do you just want to leverage your money and spend a few dollars and buy some life insurance? They're going to get the proceeds. Beneficiaries get life insurance proceeds tax-free. So, you know, you might, let's say you're a multimillionaire. So pick up a few million of life insurance for next to nothing. You know, it doesn't cost you much to do it. And if you die, that money is available tax-free instead of them having to liquidate assets to do things like pay a mortgage on your home until it gets through probate, or on your investment properties or something like that. We talked about a key man policy or a buyout policy for a partner. You might need life insurance for that. When do you not need life insurance? Well, if you're not concerned about your burial costs at all, some people prepay their burial costs and they simply don't care. They don't have assets to protect. They don't care about, they don't have any debt, right? Their spouse is going to be okay. They don't have children going through college. I hate to say it, but I'm an example of this, right? I'm a single person with no children, no worry, you know, I can pay for whatever I want, right? But I have life insurance. And I have life insurance because it leverages my money. Why would I not spend a pittance, relatively speaking, and leave somebody a lot of life insurance? And in my case, you know, it's family members and charity, right? So you might not need life insurance, but you might want life insurance. I can fund a school or a project about Bengals or whatever I want to fund with my life insurance when I die for almost no money, and they're going to get it tax-free.
Which is smart.
Yeah. So to simplify that, I think you need life insurance first to cover your burial costs, second to cover any income that might be needed, third to protect your assets and send your kids to college, right? But that's income related. And fourth is just because you want to. You want to give back to somebody. And rather than leaving them all your assets, you leave them a life insurance policy. It's a great way to give to charity, for one thing. Yeah.
So if your spouse comes to you and says they want to take out a $5 million $1,000 policy on you, at what point should you go to the police? I feel like this is how every Dateline starts.
You know, I don't know that you go to the police. I mean, I have a couple that came to mind immediately when you said that, because he did call me and say, it was $10 million, but I want a $10 million policy on my wife.
You and Keith Morrison are going to be sitting down together very soon. I'm just letting you know now.
Well, I hope not, because I have her on video saying, yes, I want it. And then she said, but I want a $10 million policy on him.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was reasonable. And we actually talked about it, and it turned out that they didn't quite need that. I think we did 8.5 on each of them or whatever. But whatever it was, we found something within their price range that covered them both. And we talked about all those reasons that they have to have it or want it. And again, for them, it was largely about protecting a business, protecting assets, making sure their kids were okay when they were gone. What if their kids ran the business into the ground? Can they still survive?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The real kinds of life things that people think about. I want to talk about term insurance before we end this, though, because, you know, it gets a bit of a bad rap sometimes, or too mm-hmm. good of a rap, depending on who you speak with, because people say, well, term insurance, it's cheap, it covers my death benefit, it's great, and I'm not going to need it when I'm older, because mm-hmm. I'll have plenty of money.
Okay.
Might be true, but right. What happens if you do need it? And mm-hmm. here's the thing. We talked about guaranteed life, guaranteed issue, because I don't think people really know the nuts and bolts of it. And for term insurance, I want to bring up this topic, because this is maybe the most important reason to pick up term insurance when you can't afford or don't want a more expensive policy.
Okay.
Most term insurance is what we call guaranteed renewable or guaranteed convertible. And what that means is that when you're young and healthy and you can afford the $25 a month premium to buy your $250,000 policy, mm-hmm. you are protecting yourself in the future, yourself, not your family. I mean, you are protecting your family, but you're protecting yourself in the future in case you become uninsurable or rateable. In other words, let's suppose you're young and healthy now, you pick up $25 a month and you pay the term. And let's mm-hmm. say it's a 25, let's say it's a 30-year term policy.
Okay.
And you're 25 years old. By the time you're 55 years old, you might have some health problems. Mm-hmm. You might have diabetes, for instance. It doesn't have to be some terminal disease, right? Maybe you just have AFib, okay? But that might mean that you may not be eligible for reasonably priced or eligible at all for a whole life policy or even another term policy. Mm-hmm. However, the term policy you have is probably guaranteed convertible, which means that they will have to, even if you're terminally ill, they have to give you, convert that insurance if you ask them to, some or all of it, you get to choose, mm-hmm. To some form of permanent insurance. And you're going to get it based on your healthy rate you bought it at when you were 25.
So that's kind of a benefit to buying early.
It is, because if you got, let's say, a preferred non-smoker rate, you know, you're out there running marathons and you don't have to be that. You just have to be in good health and non-smoking. Mm-hmm. But if you get preferred non-smoker rates, you're going to get a very inexpensive premium. Get to age 55 or 60 or 65, and now you maybe have some health problems, you're still going to get a preferred non-smoker rate, but you will have to pay for it at your current age. Still, mm-hmm. it's a great deal if you want to convert some of it. And what some people do is they pick up, you know, $500,000 term when they're young. And by the time they're getting to retirement, they're looking at, okay, my term policy is going to end. Maybe I should convert some of it. Maybe they convert $50,000 to permanent mm-hmm. insurance and they let the rest of it go or whatever. Or they do some sort of term and whole life blend. But it's really worth it for people with a term policy. Anybody listening to this who has a term policy, who is just living under the idea that my term policy will end and then what? You mm-hmm. should check to see if it's guaranteed convertible and maybe get some quotes from your broker. Hey, what would it cost me to convert 25,000 of this? 50,000, 10,000? What can I do? Find out mm-hmm. what your options are while you have that term insurance in place. Don't just let it end without knowing what it does. That's perhaps the most under-exercised value point I could give you today, is to check on your term insurance and see if you want to start converting pieces of it. You could even convert, you know, I want to convert 25,000 this year. I'm going to convert mm-hmm. another 25,000 next year, things like that. And your broker should be able to help you do that.
Quick question about, back to what we talked about in the beginning with the employee that usually offers you, if you want to do one, two, three times your salary for insurance. If you have a separate whole life insurance, do you need to do that? I mean, it seems like with the employee, it's really cheap to be able to do that. Is it smart to just do that in addition?
Yeah, I think for the money they charge you. I mean, it was $7 a paycheck right. or something to get three times your salary. I think it is a really good idea to do that. You do, however, want to check with your HR people and see if your employer is offering you accidental death benefit or real life insurance. I mean, I've seen some people, believe it or not, paying a premium that they thought and it looked like it was high enough to be real life insurance. And really, it was for an accidental policy. It only paid if they were in an accident or if they lost one limb or one eye or one hand, you know, and they were paying these premiums for something that may or may not ever happen, which is fine if they're really cheap premiums. You know, you see that ADD on your, you know, it's $1.15 or whatever. That might be worth it. But just know what you got. I mean, that's the whole deal is ask your broker, ask your HR person, have some independent person take a look at it and help you sort through it. But know what you have. And really, it can be such a tool for people. I mean, you know, we don't talk about it very often because it sort of is one of those, I don't know, it's sort of one of those background things. People go, yeah, and I have some life insurance. Mm-hmm. And then I say, do you know if it's whole life or term? I don't know. Does it build any cash value? I don't know. I think so. How much is it? I'll say, how much is the cash value? They'll say $200,000. I say, that's the cash value? I don't know. That's what they pay when I die. That's your death benefit, right? So we just don't talk about it. Nobody wants to talk about dying. And nobody certainly wants to talk about buying a policy that they must die within the term of, Jess.
Right. I don't think they're hiring me for the advertising campaign for that.
I don't know. I think.
If you think you're going to kick off within 10 years, we'll pay you.
I love that you say things like that because I think it's what we all think, you know.
Just don't say.
I'm sending this money out. What good is it to me? I'm going to be dead. But there are features that you can access when you're alive, especially in some form of permanent insurance. But just know what you've got. Use it to protect your assets. Use it as an estate planning tool. And people say, well, I'm going to leave my house to my son or daughter. Now, if you leave it to your spouse, it's not such a big deal. But you're leaving it to a child. If you haven't done a life estate, a legal document to do that, then, you know, they're inheriting your house. Well, that's fine. But now your will is in probate. Maybe for 6 months, maybe for longer. Just because you have a will doesn't mean they get the money immediately. It has to go through probate court.
Are they going to have the money to run that?
Yeah, a mortgage, repairs, whatever. And the life insurance, you know, they'd have in a week, 10 days in their hand, tax-free.
All right, well, let's get your phone number. There's a lot to this. So let's get your phone number if people have questions.
Sure. It's 413-773-3333.
All right, perfect. You can also go to hugyourmoney.com. We'll be back next week with another episode of the Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Frances Ram, right here on WHMP. Thank you.
Thank you, Jess.
Financial literacy and the human condition. Welcome to Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Frances Raham.
Hi, it's Frances. I just wanted to take a minute to thank you for watching this video. If you're catching us on YouTube, please help us help others by clicking like, subscribe, and all notifications so you don't miss any videos. And check back for the next video. I think you're going to love it. Thanks again. For more information, you can visit us at hugyourmoney.com.
Welcome to Financial Fitness. I'm Jess Tyler, along with the Money Doctor, Dr. Frances Ram. Hi.
Hi, Jess. How are you?
I'm doing good. What are we talking about this week?
All right. So this is not usually a show about math because that's hard to do on the radio, but sometimes it just comes down to crunching the numbers. Mm-hmm. And we get asked this so often, and it seems to be such a vast problem for people, stresses them out. They don't have a solution. Many people will tell me that they've called many places and they've just been told to spend less money, or they've been told to, you know, sell their car and buy a different car or some sort of simple solution, which sounds great when you're giving that advice, but not so great when you're getting it. Because clearly, if you were able to just fix it that way by spending less money or changing your car, you would have done it by now.
Right.
So the real problem that I see average households struggling with is, how come we keep making more money, but we mm-hmm. never have enough? Why is it that even with the prices of inflation, you know, my husband or wife or partner just got a raise, and still we're looking at overdraft fees? It looks like we make enough money. When mm-hmm. we sit down at the table and we look at our income, it looks like we should make enough money. It can't just be that one little emergency cropped up. There must be some sort of problem here. There's some symptom that we're not diagnosing. And so that's what I want to talk about today. And I literally want to tell people how they can figure this out once and for all for themselves. They can obviously okay. ask us for help, but we're really going to go through this. It's not as difficult as it sounds, but you have to have a logical approach, and you must remove yourself a little bit from this emotionally and just try and take the steps I'm going to tell you. I promise you, it isn't about you can't have a cup of coffee. We're not talking, you know, detailed budget here at this stage. We're talking macro picture, zooming mm-hmm. out to figure out what is the real problem.
You know, I mean, automatically, the first thing that comes to my mind is, and I think everybody's going to say this, is that when our parents were going to buy houses, the cost of the house wasn't that much more compared to their salary than it is now. Like, the difference between our salary now and what the cost of a house is so much greater that it seems unattainable.
Well, that's all true, right? That our dollar doesn't go as far as mm-hmm. it used to. I think that's a fair statement to make. But those are the kinds of things. And believe me, I'm not picking on you. I love that you say these things, because this is just what people say to me. Mm-hmm. The reason I don't have enough money is because things are too expensive.
Right.
But that's not helpful to you if you're mm-hmm. the one struggling with not having enough money and you're trying to figure out, okay, so I get that my house is more expensive. I understand that my kids are more expensive. I understand that I don't get raises that are commensurate with my increase in expenses, or perhaps I'm living on a fixed income. But how do I fix that? You know, that's just a fact of life. This stuff is more expensive. And the first thing people do is they point a finger at something and they say, don't buy so much house. Don't drive such mm-hmm. a nice car. Don't go out to eat. Well,
right.
That's great, but it isn't working, right? So here's what you have to do. You absolutely must figure out whether or not you actually have a deficit, not enough money, or you have an organizational problem, which is usually in the form of some months we're okay, some months we're not. So
what is the saying? It's too much month at the end of the money?
Too much month at the end of the money. Exactly. So I'll give you some examples. Here's an example that works for most people, how most people work their household budgets. They certainly pay all their bills, you know, the best that they can, but they're mm-hmm. also trying to save, because they know, if you listen to us, you know, hey, you've got to have emergency cash reserves,
right.
or they want to take a vacation and they don't necessarily want to keep putting it on a credit card. Mm-hmm. So they peel some money off the top, retirement fund, whatever. So they say, out of every paycheck, we're going to put $50 a month into our emergency reserves account, $50 mm-hmm. a month, or $100 a month. Let's use different figures, $100 a month into our vacation fund. And by the way, we're going to max out our 401k, and we're going to peel that money off the top before we ever get our net pay. And that should help us to save for the future.
Mm-hmm.
Seems logical, right?
Yeah.
I mean, how many years have we been hearing, pay yourself first, save off the top?
Right.
I hate to fly in the face of these lovely little quips like pay yourself first and save off the top, but I'm just going to say, colloquially, how's that working for you? Okay.
Yeah.
So we've talked about this before. If you save too much money, if there is such a thing, right? If you save too much money off the top, you end up with less money in your pocket to pay your bills.
Mm-hmm.
That's okay if you have enough money to do that. But once again, we are back to the root cause, which is, how do you identify this? Okay, let's zoom out for a minute. Macroeconomics at a household level, okay?
Okay.
I love that. Macroeconomics at a household level. Mm. Okay, so here's the thing. And this is not uncommon, by the way. People come to me and they say exactly what we're talking about. I don't get it. We make more money this year, made more money this year than we made last year. Some months it looks okay, but we're always living in terror of when the mortgage payment comes out on the first of the month.
Right. Right?
Now, there is a way to change the date of your payments to maybe organize a little bit, but that's probably not your only solution and certainly not the best solution. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But here we go. If you can tolerate me going through the math for just a little bit, I'll try and use simple numbers. Just catch the concept. I want
you to
go to
your bank. I've got my fingers ready to count.
Yes. Okay. Go to your bank account. Okay. However many bank accounts you have. Now, it gets more complicated and the problem is more prevalent among people who have several bank accounts. So they have a checking account for bills. They have a checking account for debt. They have a vacation fund. They have an emergency fund. They have a Christmas club, whatever. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
When you start to separate your money into different accounts, although it may be good for you to organize it that way, I call this lost socks in the dryer. Okay. Where do those socks go anyway?
Okay.
Okay. So the same thing happens when you have many accounts if you round things up. For instance, you just pluck out of thin air. Let's see. Last year we spent, pick a number, $1,000, $600, whatever, on the holidays. So mm-hmm. we need to put away $50 a month for the holiday. Okay.
Right.
You start putting away $50 a month. Well, maybe you end up, that's usually just a start for people, right? So at the end of the year, you've saved your $50 a month. You have $600 in your account, but lo and behold, you spend $1,000.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, that's a $400 deficit just in that one account. Now, if you're only looking at that one account, that's easy to see. But where did that $400 come from? It either came from one of your other accounts,
mm-hmm.
depleting the money in those accounts that was there to pay your bills, et cetera.
Or a credit card.
Exactly. Or it got put on a credit card. So the very first step, we're not going to forget about credit cards, I promise. But the very first step is I want you to open up your bank account statements in your bank. I want you to take 12 months, okay? So we're in October right now. I want you to go back to September of last year.
Okay.
And for every month, this is very easy to do. It's not going to be as complicated as it sounds. For every month, I'd like you to open up your bank statement, and I want you to get the beginning balance. Well, let's mm-hmm. first just do the simplest of things, really macro. Open up September of last year and take the beginning account balance out. And log it. We have a little bank account log that helps you do this, but you could build your own if you're so inclined, okay? So you just pop the number in there. There's where I started. Let's say you started at $2,000,
mm-hmm.
okay? Now, just for a moment, just to make this very simple and really zoom out, let's ignore what happens within the next 12 months. Let's go to your August statement when the month ends, open it up, and see what your ending balance was.
Okay, so you're starting with the beginning balance and ending with the ending balance.
That's
okay.
right. Because what I'm trying to do is get a really wide shot. Forget where the money got spent,
mm-hmm.
but a really wide shot of I started in September a year ago with $2,000.
Right.
And I ended a year later with $1,000.
Mm-hmm.
You have a $1,000 deficit. Okay.
Okay.
And let's make the numbers a little simpler. You started with $2,500. You ended with $1,000. You lost $1,500 somewhere. Okay.
Because is what you're saying, you should have the same balance at the beginning of every month? If it's
No. I'm taking a whole year's time and I'm saying, where is this little hole in your pocket? Okay.
Okay.
And I'm doing it right now. I'm doing it one account at a time. So if you only had one account in theory and you started out with $2,500 in September of last year
mm-hmm.
and you ended up with $1,000, right? You have a $1,500 difference. If you started with this much money and you ended up with this much money, I don't care where it got spent, somewhere over that 12-month period, you ended up with less money. Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor is sponsored by Hug Your Money. So unique, it's patented. Financial coaching and more information at hugyourmoney.com. I'm just trying to take a 12-month period. So just one account at a time. So if you start at the beginning of September, if you mm-hmm. want to start at the beginning of October, that's fine. But I want you to look at that whole period of time, right? See what you have for a deficit in just one account. Now, maybe you have a deficit. Maybe you don't. Maybe mm-hmm. you had enough money in that account and you ended up with a $3,000 surplus. You think you're okay. What about your other accounts? Now, this is where it gets complicated for people, which is why we have this log that you can just plug every account in, do it month by month, and bam, the number's right in front of you, right?
Yeah.
So you do this for every account. And at the bottom, you're going to see whether this is a deficit or a surplus across the board, right? For that 12-month period, whether you do it beginning to beginning or beginning to end, it's going to be close enough at a macro point for you to see what happened over a 12-month period. Now, the reason that you might have been questioning that is because I haven't gotten into the nitty-gritty yet, which is to look at every single month and see what's happening. But just to begin with, do you have enough money or not? Is that really the problem? This will tell you, look, we spent more across all our accounts totaled up. We spent more than we had coming in or than we made for deposits, okay? Then you can start to say, okay, we have a deficit. Let's figure out where that is. Now, it might be that that money was going into the 401k and that's still your money, but you didn't get to spend it. It didn't go into your checking accounts, right?
Right.
Or it might be something like we take money out of this account and put it in that account and we don't notice that until we look at all the accounts together. So the idea is that you have to look, first of all, at the big picture. Do you have enough money? Do you not have enough money? Then we can start to look at this, and we'll talk about this in the second half, but we can start to look at this a month at a time and include credit cards. And I promise you, by the time we're done with this, you're going to be able to identify how much money you're short, if at all, or where the problems exist. Does it just happen in February, but then it's okay in April when you get a tax refund? Right. So we'll look at those things together in the second half, if you hang in there with me.
All right. Let's get your phone number.
Sure. It's 413-773-3333.
And you can also visit hugyourmoney.com. We'll be back with part two of Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Ram, coming up on WHMP.
Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor is sponsored by Hug Your Money. So unique, it's patented. Financial coaching and more information at hugyourmoney.com.
Welcome back to Financial Fitness. I'm Jess Tyler, along with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Ram. Hi, thank you for sticking around.
Yeah, sure. You know, this is not an easy thing we're doing to do it on radio. When we do the podcast on video, maybe I'll put some slides in there to explain to people what we're talking about. But I'm hoping that it might help some people to recognize at least a starting point of what is causing these overdraft fees, what is causing them to be in the negative some months and not others, and why they can't seem to fix it.
Are there any laws regarding overdraft fees? Because they drive me nuts. Like, my thought is, like, if a bank gets a check and then you don't have enough to cover it, then don't cash it. Don't cash it for me and then charge me $36 or whatever the exorbitant amount is. And it's not just, like, if you want to get, like, a little tap on the hand, like, and I know you can have overdraft protection, but still a lot of banks charge this money and then it gets people further in the hole. Like, if anything, couldn't there be some law that maxes it out at like $5 or something? I don't know. I just feel like if you don't have the money in the account, don't cash the check.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I like that too. The banks would probably say, yeah, but that means we have to pay somebody to check your account and, you know, send you a letter and do all this stuff. And so there's a fee. And so we're going to charge you because we're trying to deter that.
I don't think the fee should be $36, but yeah.
Let me tell you, it's astronomical. This is a little side story, but I had a woman come in to see me one day, urged by her parents, you know. She was in her 30s and she just had real anxiety about money and she just didn't want to look at money. And so she would go to the mailbox, get her mail, take her bank statement and just chuck it inside. She never opened them.
Right.
She came into my office with a shoebox of statements.
Unopened. Yeah.
We opened them together. And do you know that in a year's time, she had paid more than $3,000 in overdraft fees?
That angers me so much. Like, it's hurting people that don't need to be hurt more, and then you get in a hole and you can't get out of it.
Well, to some extent, you're right, but she could have opened her bank statements and done something about it, and she didn't. So, you know, the blame is on both places, but I agree with you.
What could she have done about it? She'd still have to pay it.
Not $3,000 worth. The first time she opened her bank statement and saw that she was overdrawn, she could have talked to the bank or to a financial advisor about it and said, how do I fix this? Which is what we're about to tell you, okay? So how do you fix it? All right. Let's suppose you really don't have enough money at the end of the year. Okay. Now, how are you going to figure out where That's gone. You've done my little test of macro, right? And now I want you to start zooming in slowly. So the first thing you're going to do is take that bank account log, whether it's ours or something that you've built, make sure every account, don't tell me, hey, we put $50 a month in our vacation fund and we take $600 out, so that's a wash. If it comes in or out of an account, I want it in that log.
Okay.
Right? Because now you're going to get to look at it a month at a time. So, for instance, in the idea of a holiday account, every month you might see that $50 deposit and you might say, hey, from January to whatever, October, we're okay. Mm-hmm. But then in October, in November, it looks like we have a deficit. Yeah, because that money came out of that account. So you can't just ignore it. You can't just count those deposits like they were real deposits. You have to balance this all across the board. So when you do this, what I want you to do is open those bank statements again. And you're going to like this part because it's exactly what you're talking about. I want you to take the deposits and the withdrawals, just those two numbers. So you want to take the withdrawals and the deposits, plug them into each month of the list and see what the difference is. If you deposited $13,000 and you withdrew $10,000, you still had $3,000 in that account at the end of the month.
Right.
If you add the other accounts at the bottom, you should see the net result. And I want you to do this for every month. Now, some months you're going to see that you deposited $10,000 and you withdrew $13,000. Now, you might say, how is that possible? It's possible because we aren't looking at this one month at a time any longer. Now we're looking at it over the course of a whole year. Now, if you wanted to go back 2 years, 3 years, you could do it. But I like to get 12 months because it's a pretty good idea.
It's not overwhelming. If you said to me, go back 5 years, I'd be like, yeah, I'm out.
Yeah. I mean, there will be some people that once they get this, once they say, wow, I finally figured it out. Let me go back and do it. It becomes
right,
fun.
Right.
But for the most part, just 12 months is enough to do this. Okay.
Yeah.
So then you're going to get your bottom line, whether you had a deficit or a surplus each month at the bottom of this list, when you total up all those accounts, right? Mm-hmm. Did you have enough money that month or did you not? Again, we don't know where it went. We don't care where it went for this exercise. We just care that you have enough. Okay, or you didn't. When you look at that across the board, you're going to see that number I was talking about, whether it's a deficit or a surplus. Now, let's suppose it's a $1,500 deficit.
Okay.
So that tells you, that gives you a number. Forget where you spent the money. Don't argue about it. Just identify it. All we're looking for in this exercise is a target. Honey, look at this. After we did everything all year, the difference between where we started and where we ended up was $1,500. Yeah, I know I spent money on my nails and you spent money on your... Well, it doesn't matter, right? Somehow, we need $1,500 more to fix this problem.
Mm-hmm.
Then you might start identifying things like overdraft charges, expenses that are too high, whatever. You have to remember that's $1,500 net. Right? Take home pay that you have to fix that problem. And your next year would have to be pretty identical to this year. But try and save yourself from comments like, yeah, but this year we had a graduation party. Or, yeah, this year we had a vacation. We don't do that every year. We had this emergency expense. We don't do that every year.
Yes
you do. You just call them different things, all right? The graduation right. party turns out to be an anniversary party, and the vacation turns out to be somebody's braces. I mean, it's just going to be different stuff.
Yeah.
But one thing is really true. We tend to spend what we earn. And for people who have no idea, and that's most, dare I say, most of Americans have no idea how much they really have at the end of a block of time like that, when you put those end goals on it. That's how you can identify this and what you can do to attack it. Now, people will say, well, I ended up okay in the end because I get a bonus or because I get a tax refund or I have a problem, but only in the summer months because I'm a teacher and they don't pay me over 12 months.
Right.
You know, people have a gut instinct as to what their problem is and they can point a finger or what their solution is. They can point a finger to it like, I'll be okay when I get my bonus. But wouldn't you rather be okay every month and not pay these $36 overdraft charges or have to rob Peter to pay Paul or borrow from a parent or pay your bills late because there wasn't enough money at the end of that month to get to those places? And so now you're paying late charges. So what I'm trying to give you here in a very abstract way, is a way to identify whether you have this deficit or surplus. But we aren't quite done yet.
Okay.
Let's suppose you go through all of this and you look at these monthly things and you say, oh, well, the checking account looks okay. I think we had enough money. Go back and look at your credit card. Do the same thing with your credit cards.
Okay.
Where was the balance when you started that 12-month period, and has it climbed?
Mm-hmm.
If you started with a balance on your total credit cards of $2,000 and you ended up with a balance of $5,000, you built up $3,000 worth of debt.
So it wasn't as okay as you thought.
Right. Now, you made the minimum payments out of your checking accounts, savings accounts, all of that, right? So that's accounted for.
Mm-hmm.
But that means your deficit isn't $1,500. It's $4,500.
Yeah.
And you need to fix that, or you're going to be paying a lot of credit card interest and fees, right? If you're paying late fees or anything like that. So, you know, that's a little point I would like to make. It's an aside, but sometimes people will say to me, I don't want to pay my credit card late because I'm going to get a fee and it's going to harm my credit. Yes, you're going to get a fee. If it's late, if it's past the due date, they're going to charge you that lovely fee, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to show up on your credit until it's 30 days late. Just a thing to log in your memory banks, folks. It doesn't show up on your credit reports until it's 30 days late, but that doesn't mean you don't have to pay that fee. And that is all, in my mind, and to your point, wasted money. Overdraft charges and late fees are completely wasted money. You're just throwing it out the window. Wouldn't you rather go to dinner? You know, do a little work like this or ask someone for help, and you'll be able to identify this. Now, there's some places where there are leaks that people don't necessarily, or I don't know if they can't, but they don't factor them in. Things like, I do all the money in the household and I see that, but my husband has an account. He gets $50 a week to spend however he wants.
Yeah.
And they don't factor it in. Well, where did that $50 come from? You know, that you might be balancing everything you've got and it might look kind of okay, but that $50 a week ends up to be, you know, more than $200 a month, 4.3 weeks in a month, right? And that might be putting you in the red and you're not even noticing it, or the allowance you give to your children or something like that. Once you're done with this macro thing, that's when I want you to get micro. That's when, now, okay, we got this deficit. Where the heck is this money going? Now it's time for the budget that I'm always talking about, right? Where we identify every penny that goes anywhere from any of those accounts. And that's where the work can be done. Now you can say, okay, we're not crazy. It isn't that he spends too much on this or I spend too much on that. It just isn't. The fact is staring me right in the face. We have a deficit.
Mm-hmm.
Now we have to figure out how to solve it. And you can either earn more money or cut your expenses. Those are your two choices. There's no magic one. But there are lots and lots and lots of things that can be done. And some of them are very easy. And the biggest progress that we see is once people do the budget part, right, where they just, again, they're not even building the budget. They're just tracking their expenses. Once they've tracked all those expenses and they start to see, we spent how much in entertainment average over this course of time? We spent how much in clothing? There are, you know, it's harder to cut back on things like your electric bill, right? Things that aren't necessarily largely within your control. I mean, if you want lights and, you know, you got kids or whatever, they're taking showers, all this sort of stuff is happening that's causing your hot water bills and your electric bills to rise. It's really hard to lock down on that stuff. But other things like how much you eat out, or whether you go to get a designer coffee every day, or how much you spend on groceries or subscriptions to things, those things can be pretty easily trimmed back. And when you're feeling good about it because you're solving a problem, it doesn't feel like punishment anymore. It feels like you're getting somewhere, you know, on the same page with your partner or by yourself. You're making some real progress finally, and you have a sense of control over your spending and over whether or not you're spending too much or you have money you could save. Because after all, the goal of all of this, Jess, is to be able to free up dollars so people are not held hostage to their bills every month.
Right.
I want people to be cash positive. I want them to have cash accounts. I want them to take vacations in cash, buy cars in cash, you know, pay off their mortgage in short record time, right? That's what I'm really hoping for people. So I know this is difficult to do on the air, but, you know, I've been asked it so many times, and recently back to back three times. And I finally said, I've got to try to get the word out at least.
Yeah. And I will say, when you put stuff into the program or you write stuff down, it's surprising. Because when you're just going by memory, you tend to forget a lot of things, or at least I do.
There's no doubt. I mean, our tools are designed to be memory jogger tools, and there's a connect between your mind and writing something that isn't there with, okay, here you go. Yeah, $30. Okay. Yeah, it's gone. I mean, yeah. Lots of times people just sign their name, don't even look at the balance.
You know, I would also say, going back to your client that came in that hadn't opened up the statements in like a year, they were just all unopened. You got to check those, because I can't tell you how many times I've found that it either got like double billed for a car payment, or like an Amazon charge came out that I had no idea what it was from. There's always mistakes on there. So if you're short in your account, it might not just be you. It might be some weird thing like that.
It's a fabulous point, Jess, that you need to check your statements, your credit card statements, whether they're e-statements or paper statements, and your bank account statements, because you want to catch fraud as early as possible.
Mm-hmm. You know, and sometimes it's just a mistake like that. Like the car payment was a mistake, but it caused me to have problems with other things that I had coming out.
That's right. So, that's right. Yeah. And you might notice that, you know, on a checking account or something, you'll see a $1 charge and you don't know what that's for. That's mm-hmm. either something you approved for the moment. So they test it for a dollar and then they charge your subscription fee and you know about it, or it's somebody trying to test your account. So you want to watch out for those. When you see that dollar charge or 99-cent charge or something, you want to make sure that you know where that came from.
Oh, that's a good tip. Yeah I wouldn't think of that.
Yeah. And again, people can do this on their own if they feel like they have the skill set to do it. I'm happy to just support the idea that people are working on this on their own. If they want help, obviously, we're here for that. But this show is really about just getting the word out about some tools and techniques that you can use to make your financial life more fit, financial fitness.
There you go. All right. Well, if you need a little bit of help, what is your phone number?
Sure. It's 413-773-3333.
And you can always go to hugyourmoney.com. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Jess.
We'll be back next week with another edition of Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Ram, right here on WHMP.
Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor is sponsored by Hug Your Money. So unique, it's patented. Financial coaching and more information at hugyourmoney.com. Would you like to see your business on Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor? We offer a 15-year proven track record. We have limited openings, but are currently seeking sponsors and guests. Is your business a good fit? We'd like to start a conversation. Contact us today at 413-773-3333 or info@hugyourmoney.com.
Financial literacy and the human condition. Welcome to Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Raham.
Hi, it's Francis. I just wanted to take a minute to thank you for watching this video. If you're catching us on YouTube, please help us help others by clicking like, subscribe, and all notifications so you don't miss any videos. And check back for the next video. I think you're going to love it. Thanks again. For more information, you can visit us at hugyourmoney.com.